Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the Senior Counsel of the 9/11 Commission is reopening debate about what happened on the day of the attacks. In an eye-opening new book, John Farmer says the military response to the attack, while it was in progress, was not what we have been told. The book is called The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11. In addition to senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission, Farmer has been the New Jersey Attorney General and chief counsel to Christy Whitman when she was governor. He is currently dean of the Rutgers Law School in Newark. Mr. Farmer, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me, Brian. Appreciate it.
And this is largely about where the attacking planes were on the morning of 9/11 and where the FAA and NORAD thought they were, correct?
Yes. What the book tries to do is to demonstrate that the what we saw on the morning of 9/11 itself and the various disconnects that happened were, in fact, a logical extension of the disconnects that had occurred throughout the federal government in the decade leading up to 9/11.
And we'll get to those connections as a general principle as we go. But specifically, we were told that no one could have foreseen the attacks coming that day. But by the time the two planes hit the World Trade Center around 9 a.m., and a third was en route to the Pentagon, the system was becoming more self-aware.
That's exactly right.
So what did they claim was happening after 9 a.m., and what did you find out really happened?
Well, as you mentioned, what we were told after 9/11 in numerous media accounts and testimony before Congress, and actually in early testimony before the 9/11 Commission, was that after the shock of the first two attacks, the attacks that hit the Trade Center had been absorbed, the national command structure reasserted itself, so that by the time the third plane was heading for the Pentagon, the national command structure was back in charge, that fighter planes have been scrambled from Langley Air Force Base in Virginia to meet the threat posed by that third plane, barely missed being able to intercept that plane, and were certainly in position over Washington and had the proper authorizations in hand to deal with the fourth plane, United 93, if that plane had not been taken down by the passengers in Pennsylvania.
But really?
Well, in reality, what we found was that the military actually had no notice of the third plane. They were heading toward the Pentagon. The scramble at Langley Air Force Base occurred in response to a mistaken report in the system that American 11, the first plane that hit the Trade Center, was that had in fact not hit the Trade Center, but was still en route to Washington, still airborne en route to Washington. And so the Langley fighters were scrambled to meet that plane coming from the north, not a plane coming from the west. There was a report about a minute before the Pentagon was struck that American 77 was lost, and there was a further report that some unidentified plane was near the Pentagon, but there was no notice to the military about American 77 being hijacked. And with respect to the final plane, United 93, the military received notice that that plane had a bomb on board 4 minutes after it had crashed in Pennsylvania. So there was no, they were not tracking the plane on radar. As we were told, the authorization to shoot the plane down had not been given, as we were informed. And in fact, the FAA headquarters, which had found out about the hijacked plane some 3 minutes after it was hijacked, never managed to get the word to the military before the plane crashed.
So what's the bigger story here, that someone blew it or someone lied to us about what happened?
I think, you know, I think there was a decision at some level of government to spin what happened on 9/11, and I think it had some pretty drastic consequences, because what it left impression was that the national command structure could function from the top down in an emergency, and I think what 9/11 showed was that it couldn't, and in fact that the emergency happened, as Katrina did several years later, not from the top down, but from the bottom up, from the ground up, and by misleading the public about exactly what happened, the government, in fact, misled itself about its capacity to respond in a crisis.
The government misled itself about its capacity to respond in a crisis.
I think what we saw and that play out in is Katrina, which was in some ways a very different emergency. And in fact, I think that actually makes the point even more strongly. Unlike 9/11, which, you know, we were told the awkwardness of the response and the difficulty in the response was because it was such a shock. Katrina was not a shock at all. Katrina was an event, a hurricane in the Gulf of major proportions that, frankly, we'd been planning for decades. But you had the same kind of dynamic occur in that very different kind of emergency where you had the top officials on a conference call with themselves and a total disconnect between what they were learning, what they were telling each other, and what was on the ground. And what that's a function of is an attempt to impose a hierarchical organization structure on an emergency that actually doesn't happen that way. It happens from the ground up. And I think by misleading the public about what had happened on 9/11, the government managed to mislead itself as well.
So if 9/11 and Katrina had some of the same shortcomings, or the response to them did, does this say anything about the Bush and Cheney approach to government, or is it bigger than that?
I think it's bigger than that. I think it goes to the nature of modern government itself. And we have a federal bureaucracy that basically was evolved since World War II in response to a Cold War kind of threat. And the Clinton administration realized when it came into office that, look, the Berlin Wall has fallen. The Cold War is over. We have to, and their term was reinvent government in order to meet the new kinds of threat. And they made efforts throughout the 1990s to do that. And the book goes through some of those efforts, and some of them were successful. They reinvented FEMA in a very good way, which unfortunately was undone by the next administration. But they also were unable to reinvent government in some significant ways. They were unable to reorient the mission of the FBI fully the way that Director Free wanted to. They were unable to reorient the CIA the way that George Tenet wanted to meet the new threat. Because government's a very difficult proposition. And bureaucratic inertia is a very difficult thing to combat. And what you saw happen throughout the 1990s was the attempt of the leaders of the government to reorient bureaucracy, resistance to that that's natural in bureaucracy, and the natural tendency of bureaucracy not to communicate with even within departments, but especially between departments. And what you saw on 9/11 in those critical hours, minutes, and seconds was that very same dynamic playing out in a very compressed time period.
Listeners, any questions for John Farmer, former senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission, former chief counsel to Governor Whitman when she was in office in New Jersey, former New Jersey Attorney General, and currently dean of the Rutgers Law School in Newark? He has a book now called The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I want to get back to the events of 9/11 itself, which you tell in such granular detail in your book. But on that larger point you were just making about government, how broad a conclusion does your experience and your research lead you to about government? Because, you know, there are opponents of health reform right now who ask, do you want the people who bungled Hurricane Katrina providing your medical care? But is that just irrelevant propaganda in your own view, or do you generalize that far too?
Well, I think I don't go as far as that, because I think there has been a dawning realization in the circles of government that something needs to change about the way government's administered and the way it's organized. And I'm writing specifically about the way government responds to crisis and to emergency. So I'm not sure that the same lessons can be transferred to the context of healthcare or other contexts. But I can tell you that in the context of, you know, responding to this emerging threat of al-Qaeda and that throughout the 1990s and to 9/11 and then to Katrina, there was a resistance and an estrangement between top levels of government and the career service. And it's very difficult, I think what both of those crises illustrate, it's very difficult to change the orientation of a department that's set up to do one thing to do something else. With healthcare, you'd be dealing with, I guess, a new mission, and you could potentially organize whatever bureaucracy was put in place more effectively to deal with that new mission. So it's not as if you're taking an existing bureaucracy and saying, now you have to do health care. I think they'd have to create something new. I would be very skeptical if they were to take an existing bureaucracy that was doing something else and say, well, now you're going to administer health care. That would cause concerns based on my research.
You know, I've always wondered about even the second plane hitting the World Trade Center. It was about 15 minutes after the first. That wasn't enough time to scramble some kind of defense of Lower Manhattan?
Well, what happened was the scramble order for the first flight occurred just really as it was impacting the tower, and the planes got airborne 6 minutes later around 8:52. So they didn't really have time. Even if they had had the second plane identified and were tracking it, they didn't really have time to get there for the second tower. And you know, the second tower, the second flight that was hijacked, United 175. The transponder code was scrambled, and it took them a while to find it. And in fact, it was on the same radar picture as the first plane. So there were minutes when they were still absorbing the shock of losing that first plane and trying to find it, that the second plane, which had been hijacked, was en route to New York and deviating from its course, and it simply wasn't noticed.
And the authorization to shoot down any subsequent planes that were still in the air or en route to try to crash into another building, that authorization, which we've heard about many times over the years,
yes,
was never given, is your conclusion?
Well, the authorization was given. It was given around 10:15 by the vice president, and by the time it reached the floor of the air defense sector in Rome, New York, it was a little after 10:30. They never passed it on to any of the fighter planes because by that time there were no targets. There were no potential hijacks that were being tracked. So at that point, the authorization was irrelevant, and so that the claim in public media and in testimony that the authorization had been passed on was simply not true. In fact, when we interviewed the pilots, they basically said, we didn't know what was going on in those critical moments. They found out later. And it actually was a sound decision not to issue it to the fighter pilots because at the same time, they were trying to land all the commercial flights in the United States, some 4,000 flights, which was done in a heroic manner, actually, by air traffic control all over the country. And had the fighter pilots actually had the authorization to shoot down potentially deviating flights, well, there were thousands of deviating flights because everyone was landing at the nearest airport. So the military commanders made a sound decision not issuing the authorization to the fighter pilots.
Why was the authorization made by the vice president rather than the commander-in-chief?
Well, there's still some debate about that. I said it was issued by the vice president because that's how it was communicated up and down the chain of command in the military. The vice president and president remember that the president authorized the vice president to do that. So their view is that the president actually ultimately gave the authorization. I say the vice president simply because that's how the records reflect it.
Julie in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with John Farmer. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Good, thank you.
How are you?
Good. I'm wondering what one can reasonably expect. It seems as though there may even be just innate limitations to a bureaucracy of this size. I mean, obviously, reforming FEMA would be a good place to start, but what can actually be done?
I think that, at some level, you are bumping up against human nature, when you're
right,
talking about government. And in some ways, government does embody some of our best and worst traits. So I would say that it depends on, it's very context specific. I think when you have a relatively clear mission like FEMA does and like the Air National Guard did on 9/11, that's certainly an easier task to undertake than if you have a mammoth bureaucracy, like the State Department or one of the other large departments or the FBI or CIA prior to 9/11. Much more difficult to reform the larger the bureaucracy becomes. But I think that counsels in favor of trying to streamline the size of government and make it so that there's a command and control that's definable and a mission that's definable, and then you might have a better chance of success.
Thank you, Julie. Richard in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Richard. Whoops, now we have Richard. Sorry, go ahead, Richard.
Yes, I'm on?
Yes.
Yes, I'm wondering, I haven't been able to find in the past few years the names of any person in the Army, the government, NORAD anywhere who was held accountable either for neglect or incompetence or anything else. In fact, several people were actually given rewards, you know, raises and promotions and things. I'm wondering if the author knows of any cases like that.
Yeah, and specifically, Mr. Farmer, was anybody held accountable for the failures that you document in your book?
Well, if by held accountable you mean were they fired or demoted, I can tell you that several people left. The FAA Administrator Jane Garvey left shortly after, some of the NORAD commanders resigned. Although I don't think, frankly, that based on the conduct that day, anybody in the NORAD chain of command really had much to feel bad about. Frankly, they were acting, and they acted very promptly based on, you know, faulty information they were receiving. If there was an agency that really did not function optimally that day, it was FAA, and not FAA in the field, not FAA in the various air traffic control centers. It was really, and not even FAA in their National Operations Center. Mm-hmm. It was really FAA headquarters that had word of United 93 fairly soon after it was hijacked and failed to pass that on. And by all accounts, the situation in the FAA headquarters in Washington that day was fairly chaotic.
Well, somebody had something to feel bad about, because you wrote 400 pages and you fought for these documents for years, even after the 9/11 Commission, which you counseled disbanded in 2004. So you must feel somebody stonewalled you for a long, long time to hide something, correct?
Yes, I think if there's a fault on the operations that day, it's, as I said, the FAA in National Headquarters. There was, I think, fault in the sense of deciding not to tell the truth about what happened, and that could be laid at the doorstep of lots of people. You can actually start with Sandy Berger, who was the National Security Advisor under President Clinton, who, while reviewing documents in the National Archives in response to the 9/11 Commission, actually hid documents in his clothing, removed them from the National Archives, hid them at a construction site, went back and got more documents, and ultimately shredded them. And he actually pled to a misdemeanor, which you could question the severity of that punishment given the gravity of what had occurred. And there were also officials in the military and in the FAA who I believe did not tell the truth about what happened on 9/11. And if there are people who should be held accountable, it should be them.
A couple of quick questions and quick answers before we run out of time. For John Farmer, author of The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11, he was senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission, and he's been other things like New Jersey Attorney General and senior counsel to Governor Whitman in New Jersey. And Steve in Stony Brook has a Whitman-related question, right, Steve?
Yes, good. Thanks for taking my call. Sir, yes, as Brian just mentioned, you were lead counsel for Governor Whitman. My buddy's dad, a Fulbert colonel, was the aviator who flew the modified Huey helicopter through the gases and smoke 24, 48, and 72 hours after 9/11. They had special chemical analysis on board. It's called a GCMS. And it registered thousands and thousands of times greater than the EPA allowable limits. This was never reported on, and perhaps you have knowledge of this, but Governor Whitman, in her subsequent role in the Bush administration, basically got hung out to dry. Nobody reported this, number one, and number two, all of the odd, extremely rare cancers that had subsequently occurred for all the people who had worked in those environments. This is culpatory evidence that proves a direct link between the two, yet nobody ever came forth.
And she was head of the EPA, and as you know, Mr. Farmer, people are very angry at her for various statements that she made about the air around Ground Zero at the time, too. Do you have an opinion about any of this based on your work with the commission?
Not based on my work with the commission, no.
Or at all?
It's not something I focused on. You know, listen, I remember seeing Governor Whitman talking about the air quality, and I remember her urging people to wear their masks, in addition to saying that that the air was breathable. And I was down at 9/11 at the site, you know, for several days afterwards, and I can tell you that people, including myself, were not wearing the masks because they were too hot. And I think it's a tragedy, obviously, that the air quality was such that it might have led to people getting sick. And but you have to remember, it was essentially a battlefield, and battlefields are notoriously not safe places.
And to Steve's point about Whitman getting hung out to dry as EPA administrator, and the heroic work that his father did, and the toxic levels there.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I don't want to comment on that because I really don't know. I wasn't there. I was not her counsel at the time. I was a counsel before. I did think, as just my own personal opinion, that she was not treated fairly.
Last thing, also outside the scope of your book, but I wonder if you have any reaction as Dean of Rutgers Law School or former New Jersey Attorney General or 9/11 Commission Counsel to the decision to try those 9/11 suspects, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, in civilian court. Do you come down on either side of that as either a legal or a security decision?
Well, I think it's a very difficult decision to make, and I think you could vindicate the rule of law short of doing what the Attorney General has decided to do. I think you can vindicate the rule of law by trying them in some other fashion. I don't think equating them with your normal run-of-the-mill criminals is correct, but I do understand that the reasons he made that decision, and I share his view that the likelihood of their being acquitted is minimal, but you are planning to try them anyway in a very sensitive location, and you're affording them protections that would not be afforded somebody who was an enemy of the United States in a war. And I don't think it's a perfect analogy. It's more than a crime, and it's less than a war. And I think that our legal profession has done a poor job in conceptualizing exactly what elements of due process are appropriate for acts of terror like 9/11.
Interesting. All right. John Farmer, author now of The Ground Truth, The Untold Story of America Under Attack on 9/11. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, is your cell phone made of war minerals? Stay with us.